Welcome to Not Work, Myth, and Storytelling. This is the show where ancestral wisdom meets the modern imagination. I'm your host and lead storyteller, Marisa Gowdy. I'm a myth worker, a story healer, and a writing coach. I'm the author of The Sovereignty Knot, A Woman's Way to Freedom, Power, Love, and Magic, and the founder of the Writer's Knot and Author's Knot communities. On Knot Work, we explore the mythology and folklore of Ireland and beyond. Whether you're drawn to Celtic culture and the power of the landscape, or whether you just like a good story and expansive conversation, you're in the right place. Fáilte. If you love what you hear and want to support the show, I'd be so grateful if you'd become a paid subscriber to my Myth is Medicine newsletter over on Substack. Look for the link at the top of the show notes or visit mythismedicine.substack.com. Before we explore this week's story, I have a question for you. What about your stories? Whether it's a book project that wants to be birthed, deep, authentic writing to support your business, or a personal creative project you can't quite name yet, I'm here to support you through the entire writing process, from the initial ideation stage to the crafting of narrative and beyond. If you're ready to write memoir or a chronicle of the spiritual journey or a book that explores healing, nature, and the power of imagination, as well as the toughest truths of today, call on me. I walk beside you as you uncover the story that only you can tell. I'm a confidant who supports you through the challenges, and I'm your champion who will offer the nudges you need to get the words on the page. And yes, we hold space for the mythical and the magical all along the way. Visit my website, marisagowdy.com, to learn more about my writing coaching services and set up a free 30-minute consultation. Season 6, Episode 22, Extraordinary Everyday Culture Work with Tad Hargrave. This conversation is part of Knot Work's Myth Workers and Culture Makers series. And when I tell you a bit more about Tad and you hear our conversation, you'll realize why he's the ideal person to have on the show. Tad Hargrave is a hippie who developed a knack for marketing and then learned how to be a hippie again. Since 2001, he has been weaving together strands of ethical marketing, Waldorf school education, a history in the performing arts, local culture making, anti-globalization activism, an interest in his ancestral traditional cultures, community building, and supporting local economies into his work, helping people create profitable businesses that are ethically grown while restoring the beauty of the marketplace. You can learn more about Tad and his work at Marketing for Hippies. And deeply related to this conversation, he also writes a newsletter over on Substack called On Culture Work. You'll find the link for that in the show notes. Well, I am so excited to welcome Tad to the podcast today. And if you are a frequent Knot Work listener, you know that I tend to say something like, we begin with a story and ask for it to speak for itself before we dive into all the ways that it still resonates and matters. And, but also, we also do what I call the Myth Workers and Culture Makers series here on the show. Because sometimes it's not about telling a story, but it's about living a story, living mythologies, and figuring out all the ways in which the ancestral, the cultural works its way through our lives. And so it seemed more than apt to have Tad here with us today. He himself is the writer of a Substack called On Culture Work. In the past, it's been called On Culture Making. And I thought Tad'd be the ideal person to talk with us about what we mean by this idea of working with culture, of being worked by culture. Welcome, Tad. I'm so glad you're here with us.
Thank you. It's really good to be here. Yeah, gosh, what does it mean on culture work? I suppose the term, I heard it first from Stephen Jenkinson. It was in his Orphan Wisdom School from 2014 to when it ended a couple of years ago. And he came to this in his time in the death trade, where he saw people on their deathbed in such dire straits and realized that so much of the mayhem of those ending days for people was not individual. It wasn't personal failings. It was cultural madness appearing. And that to try to work just on the deathbeds with these individuals where it was too late for that kind of work to be done, of looking at the death phobia that was appearing in front of them all the time. Where, of course, the patient didn't want to talk about dying, their family and friends absolutely did not want to talk about dying, and the doctors and nurses were happy to collude with the idea that this person wasn't dying when they palpably, demonstrably were. But that death phobia is not an individual piece of personal baggage. It's something that is deeply cultural. And so I think this is a lot of where the Orphan Wisdom School came from, was seeing not just at the deathbed, but in so many facets of modern society, there's something larger at play that needs to be addressed. And then there's the work part. I like Stephen, how he defines his work is, it's the thing that you're least inclined to do. Not that it doesn't have a sense of purpose or meaning or doesn't bring immense joy, but it's just, well, if I had to choose between that and watching TV, maybe I'd watch TV. Mm-hmm. So it takes work. It asks something of us going beyond ourselves. That's my loose sense of culture work. But also my own understanding of culture. I mean, there's so much to say. It's hard to even try to begin to sum this up. But a dear friend of mine, Kakisimo Esquayo, who's an indigenous cultural activist from Alberta, she was speaking with a Blackfoot elder, Narcisse Blood, and he told her that it's a culture is our set of original instructions about how to live on the land in a good way. Mm. And that includes, I think, how to tend to all of the relationships between the humans, the non-human, and the unseen, you know, broadly, those three, and how to make sure those relationships are kept healthy. Because culture could also be understood as, you know, bacterial culture that's in the soil. That's what actually makes everything live. It's not just the minerals and all of those things in the soil. It's the mycelial networks, the bacterial mix. That's what turns all of the what's otherwise inert matter into food. Mm-hmm. And same in our guts. You know, this is the difference between plants and mammals, is the plants live in the soil, but with mammals, the soil lives in us. We found a way to carry the soil with us, which is the microbiome, right, which is the thing that actually turns the protein into amino acids, which turns the carbohydrates into sugar, that turns this mess that we eat into some sort of nourishment for us. And if you take the antibiotics, anyone's ever done a round of those, you know, nuclear powered antibiotics, mm-hmm, you feel I mean, there's the stomach pain, but there's also just a deep feeling of something gone awry. Right. Something is deeply off in our body. But it's strange because the bacterial culture in our gut, it's not us, you know, it's not genetically us. Come from somewhere else, decided to stick around, keep us alive. And it's not even inside of us. It's in the tube, mm-hmm, that goes through us. So it's not actually, it's inside. And yet without it, we die. And the same is true for human culture. It seems to me that one of the functions that human culture plays is a metabolic function, that culture takes the messes of our life and turns them into nourishment for the rest of the community. So the struggles, the suffering, the pain, the immense moments, the births, the deaths, all of the hellos and goodbyes of life become occasions for culture to be fed. And I changed the title of my Substack from culture making to unculture work, because I realized I don't know if culture can be made exactly. Because it's already there. It's kind of in the mix of the world, but we can feed it, we can nourish it, and we can starve it. And so to me, culture work is at least in part looking at what can we do to feed the culture that's around us? Because there's almost none. I mean, mostly I use that word very particularly myself to refer to something alive, whereas I think the dominant society, the technocratic madness that we're plunging towards, this is not culture. This is society, it's civilization, but it's not, as I would think of it, as culture. It's a shared understanding, but it's a shared understanding that's based on the machine, not on life.
Right.
And so we want to feed it. And also, I think inherent in culture work is that there are certain things we have to be wary of because they're antibiotic in nature and that they kill culture. And I actually think that's so much of what the old folk tales tell us, is how do you live in a way that feeds culture and how do you live in a way that starves it? I mean, there's very simple things like don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. Because why? Those things are so erosive and corrosive to culture.
Right. So what I'm hearing you name is so much of the way in which culture is so enduring and so perennial, but also so fragile all at once. You know, that sense that it is not necessarily inevitable. We can almost live without it. We can almost live on any sort of extruded meat product filled with nutrients grown in a lab. And yet that is still a version of living that we would recognize. And at the same time, we know that the perennial nature of culture itself, we know all the different strands of stories we pull together and all the different rituals and ceremonies and all these different things that have endured in spite of what might be seen as the dominant culture's best efforts to flatten everything down and be able to sell it at the megaplex and then use the existing IP in order to create 17 sequels. But I, you know, the fact that you started there with exploring death as that moment of recognizing that we have a culture that refuses to understand the absolute nature of life itself. And then that idea that culture is our set of original instructions that I think we also can live again without necessarily heeding if that set of instructions is about relationships. I think you named it's the unseen, human, and the more than human, right? And we almost live without seeing those a lot of the time. And I use we very consciously because I know there's days when I'm very connected to my culture work and I know why I'm wearing my Bridget's cross around my neck. And other days, it's this necklace that sort of pokes me in the neck that was made out of a metal that I don't know where it comes from, but it was given to me with love. So thank you for setting us up with all of the paradoxes of our metabolic function that says sometimes we are well and sometimes we are healthy. And it calls in our sense of life and as well as the death of culture. So there's so much to start from there, Tad. Thank you. Thank you. Paradoxes there.
Something that comes to me is a Stephanie Mackay, who you had on your podcast recently and whose work I commend to everybody. One of her great passions is to, how do we start as people of European descent rebuilding what I might call a kind of culture feeding, life feeding ceremony that's not going to brown people and saying, can we borrow your culture? That's not going to other cultures that seem more exotic and funkier because of our own self-loathing that we're white and homeless and so desperate for a home that we'll culturally appropriate and take, you know, and live out just one more iteration of that. And so her enormous gift is being able to see the vestiges of what might have been intact ceremony and ritual in these stories. And through those pieces, beginning to cobble something together. It occurs to me that with the culture work, this is something enormously practical that everyone can do. And my guess is, in our own ancestral traditional cultures, people didn't just get together for ceremony. It's a very modern thing. Like, we're going to get together. We're going to do ceremony. For what? Why? What are we talking about? But these ceremonies would be a part of the natural ebb and flow of life and certain moments. And so in the modern world, one could be when somebody new moves to a community, how do you properly welcome them to the community in a way that they feel really landed? If somebody's leaving a community, can you get together and try to stop them? Can you get together and make sure they know as they leave the size and shape of the hole that they're leaving, as you bless them on the road, but can you help them understand the substance that they have. When somebody dies, can we do this? The Irish have this enormous wake tradition. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure you know more about than me. When babies are born, mm-hmm. could that become a chance for a kind of village making culture work? Where instead of privatizing it, which is the way of modern society, we democratize it. We involve more and more people. When there's a conflict in our communities, instead of just gossiping about it and everybody throwing fuel on the fire of bitterness and rancor and grievance, mm-hmm. could we bring more people in? Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of ways to think about ceremony or ritual, but I think one way to think about it is it's a kind of, you're trying to slow things down so that something can actually happen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just finished reading a draft of Stephen Jenkins's new book, Matrimony, mm-hmm. where he looks at weddings and similarly trying to put together some of the shards that we have vestiges left. There's still elements of what might have happened in traditional cultures in the modern wedding. But then how could we reimagine a way of doing this that feeds something alive and that matters, that feeds the soul, that's genuinely, truly beautiful? Instead of, like, I remember I went to my cousin's wedding in Spokane, and my mom and I arrived a couple of minutes late. So I thought, but they were already at the end of the ceremony. Mm-hmm. 15 minutes later, you know, it was done and dusted, and we went. And I was sitting there, and I kept looking at the program, and I was looking at my phone, and I was like, did we get the time wrong?
Right.
And I must have checked it 25 times. I thought, is my phone? It's like, no, it automatically syncs to the time zone I'm in. And I really couldn't comprehend what was going on. How did we miss it? Mm-hmm. And I finally, the woman next to me, she said, oh no, it just started 2 minutes before you got here. So the whole wedding ceremony was 15 minutes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's become the motto, you're in, you're out, and let's party, because the partying is the thing.
Right.
And so it happens fast enough, and it's highly mm-hmm. scripted enough that nothing weird will happen.
Right. No vulnerability. Yeah.
Yeah, there's no vulnerability. There's no openness to life. There's no openness mm-hmm. to the other side. I mean, I remember sitting with a fellow who would run grief rituals, and the thing was going to start at 9, but I think it was like 9:05, 9:10. He was still just sitting there chatting outside. And I asked him later, so why didn't you just start? And because I think everybody was there. Mm-hmm. He's like, well, not everybody was there. Mm-hmm. I said, I think everyone was there. He said, not from the other side. He said, you either credit the possibility that the other side is real.
Right.
And you need them to be involved. And so you wait for them to show up. And so he was kind of waiting for the sign that it was time from them to begin.
Yeah.
So it's, I would just say for the listener, it's to think about what's something that's happening in your community that is the trouble, your own or somebody else's, that could be hijacked and turned into something that might have a chance at feeding and fostering some kind of real culture and building some kind of real community. Mm-hmm. And nobody will ask you to do it because nobody remembers that it can be done anymore.
And does it also come in with a matter of, do people feel as if they don't have permission to do so? You mentioned before that kind of the specter of cultural appropriation, you know, sure. We can, I think, become so overly careful, perhaps out of a spirit of reverence, of wanting to say, I don't want to go and replicate all the mistakes in the books that I read. And that sense of then being afraid to court the unseen, to call in that sense of creativity in any way that might be seen as earnest. You know, I think we celebrate creativity, but we want it very much at the level of playfulness and, oh, isn't this lovely? But that union of maybe that work of spirit might be the right word for it, and enacting creativity in real time with others watching, it seems very frightening. And I think I'll name that, I see it in myself, because I look at my, you know, how have I missed those opportunities with my own children? Because I think of community, it begins with the people you live with every day, right? And when you don't have the culture offered to you by the church that maybe some of us grew up with, we didn't give it to the next generation, the frameworks are missing in certain ways.
Yeah, there's going to need to be a lot of creative moves. And I think we can find a lot of guidance in our old folk tales and stories. They're the hints of what this could look like. But I'll give an example. A dear friend of mine moved to Australia, met a guy, you know how it goes. And when she left, we didn't know how long she'd be gone, and she didn't either. And she left. I mean, she must be there, been there 6 years now. But she was coming back, and she wanted to see her friends. But it was, she was going to have one day, and you know how it is. It's punishing. You're back for one day, and you don't have time to go for coffee with everybody. And it's also, she'd been gone a year or two, and it was overwhelming because the loneliness had been so powerful. She's suddenly in a foreign country, foreign ecosystems, foreign accents, just so dislocating. And her yearning to be back in Edmonton, to be home, was so powerful. And the yearning that she felt to see other people was so big, and she just didn't know how to deal with it. And I helped her with the farewell. She said, could you organize something? And I said, sure. And I really, at the moment, I said yes. I just thought, well, yeah, I'll host it at my house. We'll have a potluck and that'll be it. I wasn't thinking of anything in particular. But then the night before, she came by, and I was sitting on my porch and we were talking, and I looked at her and I just thought, you are gossamer right now. You just, or the wrong look could just knock you down. She was so vulnerable and overwhelmed with being home and the thought of seeing everyone the next day. So an idea began to form. I said, look, come tomorrow. People are going to arrive at 1. You come at 11. And so she came at 11. And I said, I sat her down. I said, look, here's the deal. This could happen too fast. And it's going to blow your circuits. And you don't get to enjoy it. And also, there's some education that could happen for these people about how do we go about this. Mm-hmm. And so I said, you're going to wait in the back room. I'm not going to tell anyone that you're there. But you can let yourself start to arrive just by hearing the voices of the people in the living room. Mm-hmm. Read a book. Take it easy. But just let that help you arrive. And around 1, I'll call you out. I said, but when you come out, I said, we're going to ask you to come out. And you've got to refuse 3 times. Yeah. And just find ways to refuse, find reasons. When you come out, you're going to be wearing a scarf around your head. So we can't see you. And you can't really see us. She said, okay. I mean, enormously trusting. And the friends came and we hung out, and it was, you know, Chillsville, and people were saying, oh, where's Olenka? And I would tell them, that was her name. And I said, she's not here yet. She hasn't arrived. And which was true. She was not really there. But finally, around 1, I took everyone outside and I said, okay, here's the deal. She's been in the back room since 11, but I wasn't lying to you when I said she hasn't arrived. And we are going to help her arrive back home now. And we're going to go in and we're going to ask her to come out, and we'll see what happens though. So we went in, said, Olenka, your friends are here. Would you come out and join us? And I think the first one was just, I don't think I can, you know, I'm a little nervous to open the door, you know, and see all your faces. I've been missing you so much, and laughed. And I said, okay, well, maybe, I remembered at her farewell, she'd said that she wasn't sure. Oh, you know, people just forget her. And I said, so maybe as everyone, we just start sharing stories about, let her know a good memory you have of her, that we remember who she is. And so this began to happen, and people shared, and I asked again, so could you come out? She said, no, I it's so hard for me, because I, so many times out at night, I would look up at the stars and I'd think about you and I'd call out your names, and I didn't know if any of you were calling out my name and any of you missed me really while I was gone. And she was really weeping. She was really crying. And then I said, okay, so you heard what she said. She knows you remember her, but she's not sure you missed her. So this is now a time to share a story of a time when you wish she'd been there. Maybe it was a party that you're like, oh, this would have been more fun with Olenka here. And people had the stories. And I said, Olenka, you've heard that we remember you and we missed you. Would you come out? And then she was properly sobbing and almost incoherent, and she couldn't come out. So that was the third time. I said, okay, maybe what will help her is a song. Does anyone have a song that they could sing? So this is a chance where it's kind of culture feeding, or you're employing the cultural skills that somebody might have. I'm hoping somebody's got a song.
Yeah.
And it turned out she'd been a part of a choir in this house that she'd been in. And a lot of those people were there. So they started singing the song that she knew that she'd sung. And then the door opens and slowly she comes out with her head, you know, covered. And I had a chair facing away from the circle. I had her sit down. And I said, okay, so now here's what's going to, and I told people, so when she comes out, don't look at her. Don't try to stare at her. Eyes down. She's covered. At some point, she's going to slowly unwrap if she can. And she'll turn to us and your eyes will come up and somehow we'll meet each other somewhere in there. And so she sat down and she slowly kind of unwrapped a little bit. And her friend Bella was sitting on the couch next door. I brought her over. And I said, so now we're going to hear from Olenka, because she's heard a lot from you. So now we're going to hear from her. But she's going to say it through Bella, because that's a lot to ask to suddenly face and be speaking. So she was just whispering it in Bella's ear, and Bella then spoke for her on her behalf. And then eventually, you know, like I turned around and the scarf was off and she was able to share. And we kind of found each other in this very sweet place. And then a number of us had learned a song. It was this old Eastern European song with multiple harmonies. And so we sang that to her as well. And so that's a cultural move too. It's like, okay, how can we bring some of this old culture into the today, right now? Mm-hmm. But what I was trying to do was to do something that would give a group of people who'd probably never done any, I'd never done anything like this, mm-hmm. but to give a group of people an experience of slowing something down enough so it could actually happen, so she could actually arrive, so she could be there. Because I knew she was either going to be mauled by people's enthusiasm or she'd be mauled by their casualness. Mm-hmm. It's a brutal thing to come home from a big trip and you're greeted with like, hey man, what's up? As if you never went away, as if your absence had no consequence. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, it's also if everybody's just in your face and it just really does blow the circuit. So that was us trying. That was us attempting to do something. And whatever it is, you know, there was another event where there was a conflict in the permaculture scene in Edmonton, and it really divided the whole thing. And 6 months, I was so busy. And 6 months later, we're still there. And I was at an event and they were all there. And I went up to them individually. I said, look, I've heard there's this trouble. Do you want help? Mm-hmm. Yes. Do you want my help? I'm willing to help try to build this bridge. They all individually said yes. I said, great. But my thinking was, how do I do this in a way? It's not just privatized. Get these two people, I'm emailing each other, not even meeting, or just sit down with them personally. But how could we make this a bigger something?
Yeah.
And so I sent an email to everyone. I said, here's the deal. This is my pitch. Coming up to summertime, you're all into permaculture. You're busy. So what I'm going to invite you to do is to plant something that we could put in a soup, in a stew. Mm. And you tend to that as a part of the preparation for this. Number two is I'm going to invite you to write a letter with your memory of the incident, because there was a particular incident during a meeting. I want you to share your memory of what happened and how it happened. Mm. I'm going to gather those all up. And once I've got them all, I'll send them back to everybody. So everybody has six different memories of the thing. And I'm going to invite you to read it carefully, because I knew that not even people remembered it the same. And I wanted them to see that, so they didn't have this sense of like, my memory is the sanctum sanctorum of how it was. And I said, and then we'll meet probably 5 or 6 times to work this through. Immediate response. That's, wow, that's a lot. That's more than we were thinking. So there was a kind of rumble about it being too much. I said, okay, fine, counter proposal. You still plant the food. You still write the thing. One meeting. With the proviso that if we don't handle it in that meeting, we keep meeting until it's done. Mm-hmm. Well, I just think, Tad, maybe you're too connected and we should get a more neutral mediator. And so thank you very much for all your work. But no, nothing happened. That division is still there in the community. Hmm. So that's the other side of it. Yeah. And that wasn't even the thing, because the next move I was going to do that I hadn't even told them was, okay, each of you 6. You now need to find 3 people in the community who are going to make something that we're going to use in this. And we're going to take all the plants. We're going to make a stew. That's what's going to feed us over these meetings. But you're also going to get 3 people who maybe do some cordage or some string, and we're going to use that in the ceremony. But the idea is trying to open the gate so that more people get involved in a contained way. Mm. And so that more people learn, because I'm just not that interested in doing a conflict resolution between 2 people if it doesn't build the cultural capacity of the rest of the community.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much for giving us both that, really the scene of everyone coming together to welcome your friend home. I had tears in my eyes the whole time you told it. And we could have kept it there at this Heiner. Look at the time that Tad made culture, and it was so beautiful. And we learned about arrival, and there was this gorgeousness of making myth come alive. But you gave us the other reality of the sense of this is hard work, as you named at the beginning. Like what? Wouldn't we all want to do culture work? It's so important. Nope. Watching TV would be way easier than the vulnerability required to go to those meetings and be wrong and be more pissed off and say, I didn't want to go there. I didn't want to know you thought that of me, or whatever it might be that's part of those stories. But you know what I keep realizing too? I'm a mother of 2, and they're 15 and 11. And I realize how, granted, they're pandemic kids, so they had a fractured experience in so many ways. And we can look back at the difference of how we got to raise 1 versus 2. Also in the way in which you're naming that, the consciousness of coming together as a group. We might offer that to children, but then it becomes kids stuff. And then we become, atomized beings inside our private homes. And that sounds like something we might have to, send a lot of emails about in the mom group to get together. And I don't necessarily think the right word is innocence, but I think there's something about that word that's connected to what you're naming in the power of inviting someone to arrive. Because, just incidentally, I keep thinking of, I'll be going back to Ireland myself this summer. And all the times when I go up to Prince Edward Island, where my family's from, the struggle to arrive is a very private one that I do well at some years and not so well at others. And you've just planted something within me, albeit in a very individual way, of how can I, I'm going to be traveling with other people in Ireland. How can I invite them to help me arrive and be there with me? So thank you for that gift. But I don't know. Is there something interesting in this idea of innocence? Is there play in that word or that concept? I'm not sure if that has anything to do with you with this idea of culture work, or if that just seems keyed in those particular stories.
Well, it strikes me, I don't know, life, eventually does disabuse most of us of our innocence, mm-hmm. but there becomes, it's not a given that the hardships of life create grief. And it's not a given that the good times create gratitude. Mm-hmm. That's strangely, you can be on the receiving end of enormous good fortune and not feel grateful for it. Mm-hmm. Like all of us waking up today and still being alive and a lot to be grateful for, but somehow it's just not landing for us. Yeah. And then you can be in the midst of a situation that would seem to require, mandate, obligate us towards grief, and there's no grief. Mm-hmm. Instead, there's grievance. Mm. And this to me is maybe speaking to the jadedness of it. Mm. And I think the reason, or one of the reasons, that we are such a profoundly cynical, jaded, grievance-filled society is for the lack of culture. because none of the bitterness has been metabolized. I mean, humans are petty creatures. I remember talking with a fellow, Ron Evans, a Chippewa Cree storyteller, medicine man, and he, I don't know, medicine man, storyteller. He was talking about some of the stories of the first human. This character was Sakijak. And he is sometimes so naive and innocent and foolish and gets himself into all kinds of trouble, gets himself killed regularly, brought back to life, I think, by coyote. And other times so generous and kind and sometimes cynical and selfish and bitter and stupid. And he's all of it. And he said, our understanding is that's who humans are without elders and without culture, without traditions. Mm-hmm. And so when you have elders and culture, we're a little bit better, but not much. So the bitterness is there. It's kind of built in. And I think one of the functions of culture is to make sure that the grievance gets metabolized back down to grief, that gets composted so that new life can grow, that it doesn't become concretized and rigid, but it stays subtle. It turns all these troubles into food. Because I tell you, if you leave a community, and most of us probably have at this point, especially a community you invested in, and you felt yourself in your smaller moments to be a grand part of that, you know, needed, inextricable, but here you are extricating yourself. And then you see nobody's trying to stop you. Mm-hmm. There's no farewell for you. Mm-hmm. There's no nothing.
Yeah.
And it's hard not to have that make us bitter, mm-hmm. to feel immensely hurt. And then that hurt, you know, festers into this kind of chip on our shoulder that we carry around for the rest of our days, of how we didn't get met. And so, and this can happen with conflicts. When people are approaching dying, of course, there's just grievance galore. So for the lack of culture, we get this grievance. And Martin Prechtel had a line, he said, for the lack of grief, we go to war. Which then creates more grievance, which then creates more war, which creates more grievance. And so the culture making to me is a chance of how do we let the thing live? How do we help life actually happen in a way that's healthy, that's good? So that if somebody leaves, they can leave with blessings and they can be gone with remorse, but no regret. Mm. And also knowing that they're missed, feeling as they go, they most keenly feel their substance and consequence. Mm-hmm. Things they didn't realize until they were leaving about the impact they had, that this can be a gift that we give people. And yeah, when people arrive, we can help them arrive properly in a good way so that they've really landed. I mean, but I remember hearing it, some friends in Wales, they had just on the very, very west coast of Wales. And there was an Italian family, the Bakers, in the community, and they were leaving. Or they're going to be moving, and the whole community got together, brought gifts, and begged them to stay. Mm. We can't imagine this community without you. You can't go. Mm. We won't let you. We're going to bar the doors. You have to stay. And they stayed. Wow. I mean, can you imagine living in a community where people do that, are willing to take their... And then if you still say, I got to go, I can't stay, I wish I could, but I can't, that they would... then say, okay, then go with our blessings, but let's make sure we heap them upon you. And we're going to give you so many blessings that we're hoping it'd be too heavy and you stay anyways, you know.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of ways we can do it, but it does take a kind of moxie. It takes a bit of hijacking and a willingness to fail and fall on my face, a willingness for it to go wrong. Like I remember some friends of mine, they heard about the farewell that I did for my friend. One of my friends, she said, yeah, I'm leaving too. And I said, oh, are you having a farewell party? And she said, well, yeah, I was thinking. I said, who's going to host it? Because you don't host your own. Just like you don't initiate your own kids, you don't host your own farewell. Mm-hmm. And so she said, oh, well, how about you? I said, I don't want to get this reputation that I'm the goodbye guy. So I said, but I tell you what. And here's another example of culture making at work. I said, if you can find some younger people who you think, or kind of your peers, but in that age group, who you think would want to learn something about this, about how to host a good farewell, have them come and ask me and have them bring gifts. So there's some kind of, you can start to teach people about protocol. And they did, and they were very earnest and sincere, and they came with gifts and they spoke really beautiful words. I took 3 hours and I said, take notes. And we just went over the whole worldview of this.
Yeah.
And then they tried and it didn't go so well. They got together and the two people, there were actually two women that were leaving, they ended up just sort of taking over the facilitation. And I was talking with one of them in Victoria. She was visiting. And I got the sense, so wait, did you asked these people to facilitate, but then you kind of took over. It's like, yeah, they were really struggling with it. And I said, look, I understand 100%. It's a real farewell. You're really going. This is really goodbye for you. And you want it to be good. Mm-hmm. And they're f***ing it up. And you asked them. So now you got to deal with the pain of how bad this is, plus your regret that you picked them in the first place. And what is this going to mean for your friendship? All this is probably going through your head. And I said, but you have to let them fail. The proper thing is you ask them. And so the proper position to assume is you just let them do it and you let it fail. Why? Because if it fails, people learn. Mm-hmm. If you rescue them, they don't. Like Stephen, he was doing a wedding on his farm and 160 people there. And this beautiful, the walls hadn't gone in, a beautiful timber frame kind of mead hall. Mm. And we're all gathered around. And he said, and everyone had brought a gift. And the idea was you would lay it. There was an aisle between the two sides, the bride's people, the groom's people, roughly speaking. And you'd lay a gift down. But when you lay down, you say some gifts. And it's like, here's sort of why this gift for this side of the room. And the gifts weren't going to go to the bride or groom. The gifts were for the people on the other side. Mm. So this is Stephen attempting, you know, some sort of fostering of culture and trying to sing a song that's going to trigger a memory that people have in their bones of a time they haven't lived. It says, you get it, you have the gift, boom. And you're going to put down, there's going to be one pile here and then one pile over here. This one for those people, this one for these people. Great. And he said, there's 160 of you. We're going to have 8 hours. There's no lunch break. I want everybody to talk. So then you think, okay, you're going to do the math on this. Like you just got to kind of be clear, be brief, be seated. Mm-hmm. Boom. You got to hit the mark. And Stephen was sitting at the front and he didn't say anything the whole time. But people got up, but some people nailed it. And then some people talked for half an hour, lost themselves in the, you know, the helium of the floodlight of attention. Yeah. People have never been listened to their whole life, finally on being heard and got drunk on it as we do. And so by the end of the day, we had to end it. And there were a lot of people who hadn't spoken. So the rest of the gifts went in, there was the exchange. But I remember driving back and we were venting about this. Mm. Like these people, they just took all the time. Blah, blah, blah. And the next morning we were talking about, and Stephen sort of, I mean, kindly unpacked it, but he just said, look, yeah, how does this happen? He says, there's no shame, but how does it happen that this is a real wedding of two real people here and you turned it into a chance to talk about the history of the suffragettes and tell us your life story? Like, how did this happen? Mm-hmm. And the next time there was a wedding that Stephen led, I saw all the people who'd been at that wedding. When they got up with their gifts, it was Shazam. It was potent. It was clear. It was beautiful. Right. No fussing around.
Yeah.
We'd learned from the mistakes.
Yeah.
And so this is part of the culture work, because there has to be an understanding that most of it will fail right now. Mm-hmm. But then, so the next generation, yes, on one level, the people watching, they're inheriting the failure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But they can learn from that. But what they're also inheriting is the fact that people were willing to try something.
Right.
That people were willing to take a risk and roll the dice for a better day and do something that they may not have been invited to do exactly. That nobody really was searching around for somebody to do it. But they said, hey, I could do this for you. Mm-hmm. And it didn't totally work, but it didn't totally fail. And it's not a bad thing. I remember a guy from Thailand, John, he runs a beautiful retreat called Pun Pun, kind of permaculture space. And so what have you learned from teaching people how to build homes? Because that was a lot of what they do, straw bale. And he said, you always show them your worst home. Like, here's a home I built, because what you want is for them to look at it and think, I could do better than this. You want them to think that. So, you know, it failing is not bad. It's not bad that people leave thinking, I could do a better job. Okay, because maybe they will.
Right.
And the more times we do these things, the more we're willing to, like, for example, if you had a, you know, there's a family and they're expecting a child, and the child's coming in a few months, and you ask around and you realize nothing's happening. Like, there's no collective preparation for this.
Right.
And you've read some books about the fourth trimester, and you know how hard it is for mothers in the aftermath, and you know that there's certain foods and that they should be eating to replenish their body, and they got to get all the bone broth and the animal organs and the butter and the all this, and you know that she should really just be resting for that fourth trimester and being taken care of. You know the husband is going to, nobody's going to be sleeping, and it's just going to be a wash in beauty and bafflement and exhaustion and depletion. So then you could be the person that says, okay, we're going to get the community together, and you organize it so that the parents don't have to. You wrangle the whole community and you say, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to get the meal train going. I mean, blessedly, that still happens. There's still people who will do that. Somebody else says, I heard about this closing of the bone ceremony that they do, and maybe we could bring that in. Okay, great. You contact this person. What else do we have? Maybe we could go clean their home. A couple times a week. Great. Who's in on that?
Right.
And it's work. It's the thing that people are least inclined to do. Because, I mean, the counter pitch is this. Hey, everybody, you know, you didn't get to the end of that TV show, This Is Us. The final season is out. I mean, you could just stay, you know, you're going to cry. You know, it's just going to do it for you. So you could just stay at home and watch that. Or you could be involved in this and take on some heavy labor. Right. It's not always an easy pitch. But if somebody's willing to be the wrangler. And make all this happen, then what happens is other people see it happen.
Right.
And they get to know, oh, there's another possibility of what we could do that could feed something cultural in between us. Mm-hmm. And once you've experienced it once, it's very hard to, you know, if you've been through to a really amazing wedding and then you go to a mediocre wedding, it's almost intolerable.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, Tad, there's so much here that's so very boots on the ground, you know, and I'm just very aware of that and knowing that for myself, so much of my work has been, it's so digital, you know, especially for those of us who do cultural work from several thousand miles away, connected to another place very intimately. I've noticed myself that as I extend this work, my own work with story and learning from people from around the world, it's changed my relationship with some of my local relationships. And I take this as inspiration of, oh, that's part of what's been missing for me. I've been noticing that myself in terms of we're humans with limited capacity. And sometimes when we get immersed in things for many reasons, and whether it's because of the magic glowing screens that allow us to connect with people from around the world, or whether it's just the busy that is, you know, we're in our own vehicles driving our kids to individual places, there's this fundamental call that you're offering that I think is far from simple. Like it's that sense of having the challenging conversations with people saying, hey, let's elevate this beyond everybody bring a six pack and going somewhere. But it's also just remembering to make the invitation in the first place, and whether you're returning to communities you've had, you may have neglected, or doing the brave work of saying, hey, this is a place where the dog walkers say hello and then they keep passing by, but we haven't done enough of the work to bring people together. And I don't know, I think I come across that a lot, as it's all too easy to miss even that initial first step, because I think a lot of our listeners will hear you describing a very close-knit community that for them may not even seem vaguely possible yet. There's maybe elemental work that needs to get done, even in just having a chat with the neighbor who, you know, shares the driveway next door, and then taking it another step deeper.
Well, I would say we could imagine there's three levels. The first is you start saying hello to people.
Right.
Martin Prechtel, in his audio lecture series, Come Sit by My Fire, his first session, it's like an hour and a half of him talking about the importance of saying hello. But greeting people, because, you know, as he says, you never know, peace could break out at any time. You just start saying hello to strangers. So that's one, is being more friendly. Very simple things. Especially if you're in a community where it's like, I really don't know people. Learn the names of all the staff who work at all the stores and restaurants and cafes. learn their names. Mm-hmm. Then you start to learn a little bit about them, and you can take notes. It's allowed. You can put it in your phone. Have a little note for this cafe, and you start keeping track.
Yeah.
And then you might, because you know that this person is into this kind of book, and you come across a book like that, and you bring it to them as a gift. And you say, I just was thinking about you. And they almost burst into tears as somebody was thinking about them.
Yeah.
Customer at their cafe where they don't know hardly anybody's.
Yeah.
So you do this as level one. It's just the kind of saying hello. Level two, you can start hosting. And I think this is probably 90% of it. Because, mm-hmm. you know, I'm talking about very sort of profound, heavy gravitas gatherings. But most of it should be fun. Mm-hmm. Some of it is potlucks. Mm-hmm. It's not a rip your heart out kind of, God, it's just life is so hard. It's people getting together, sharing songs, and you can start to build capacity that way. You have picnics and barbecues, but you, David Brower, who was one of the grandfathers of the environmental movement, every Sunday in San Francisco, he would host his waffle brunch, and all the big names in the environmental movement were there. You just had to kind of be in the know, and every Sunday he had his waffles. So you can do things like this, just low key, small, low effort, because it can't all be the big stuff. People burn out on that.
Right.
You have games days. You do that kind of thing. And then every once in a while, there's a big need. Mm-hmm. Again, the hellos and goodbyes mm-hmm. of life. And you won't be able to do all of them. But every once in a while, you'll see one. You say, okay, I'm going to throw myself into this. I'm going to do what I can. Mm. Or somebody's in need. Somebody's going through a really hard time, and you pull the community together and say, we got to keep this person standing. Right. So here's how we're going to do it.
Right.
And then again, people see it. People get exposed to it. And the more they're exposed to it, the more likely they are to do it. And then maybe if there's a level four, you can do what Stephanie Mackay is working on, is you go back to your own ancestral culture, because it's like when they came over from Ireland, fleeing the famine, you could imagine there's a mother not knowing what she's going to find, and in her baggage, wrapped up in a moist cloth, is a little bit of sourdough that she's bringing from the old country to use as a starter wherever she goes, so that cultural memory of her people can come with her. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have. As much has been lost with the Inquisition, the witch burnings, Charlemagne, all the madness in Europe, the famines, the wars, the clearances. Even with all of that and so much being destroyed, there's so much left. There's such enormous cultural wealth. And we can take that and see if we can do something with it here where we live. We can look at the vestiges of our own ancestry and just say, what did they do in the old country? And could some version of that be reborn here in a different, never before seen way in this land, informed by the place that we are and you know, the connections that we have? Because when they came from the old country, most of the old people stayed because they couldn't make the journey.
Yeah.
A lot of the ones who went on the journey didn't make it across, mm-hmm. you know, typhus and all this on the boats. So you largely had a lot of young people showing up on the shore, largely bereft of their traditions.
Right.
And without a lot of the cultural bearers of these traditions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's a chance to go back to some of that, which is also, a lot of it is forgotten in the old country.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're just as modern as us.
Right.
But, you know, all around the world, I think there's a chance that we can say, is there any of that sourdough left that we can turn into something that could feed people today?
Yes. Mm. Wow. Well, Ted, I'm so grateful that we landed there. Really, again, calling together the magical and the pragmatic, and calling together the what we might imagine as the ancient and what's being created now, as well as the diversity and the unity. That really was a gorgeous way to call everything together. So thank you so much for taking us on this adventure today. as we close, you know, we didn't talk about your professional side of life and your work with Marketing for Hippies, but maybe we'll come back and have that conversation another time. I'm so grateful that we got to really linger in this culture work, which, as you say, is slow stuff, and it deserves the time that the sourdough takes to rise. But as we close, how would you like to leave our listeners with any ways to track you down and your work and how to follow you, or any other recommendations you might have?
Well, first thing, thank you for the work that you do, keeping these old stories alive, giving them a voice, giving a place where people can get introduced to new old stories. Thank you for that. It's just so beautiful. Because outside of that, these stories just sit in books on shelves, and you know, they don't get to live, and you're breathing air onto the old smeared coals of them. Mm-hmm. So is that number one. Number two, I would urge everyone also to check out Stephanie Mackay, stephaniemackay.ca, if you're interested in some of the things I said about that. And then, yeah, the professional, the marketing stuff, that could be a conversation for another time. Marketingforhippies.com is the website, but marketing for storytellers could be a topic we get into down the road. Yeah. But thanks for all that you do.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in to Not Work Myth and Storytelling. Please subscribe and review the show on your favorite podcast platform, and do share this episode with other lovers of mythology and story. By the way, everyone is a lover of mythology and story, even if they've forgotten. Creating this show is a labor of love, and your support will help me continue to craft and share stories throughout this season and beyond. Please consider becoming a paid subscriber to my newsletter, Myth is Medicine, over on Substack, where you'll find new writing and conversations each week. You can find out more about my writing, my book, our online writing communities, as well as how to work with me as a writing coach at marisagowdy.com. Gratefully, I live, write, work, and record this podcast on the ancestral lands of the Munsee Lenape tribe, whose name means original people. Music on this show is performed by Beth Sweeney and Billy Hardy.